From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, it is Giving Tuesday, and one company that is working to engage businesses and people in the AIDS and COVID pandemics is Red. They do it by partnering with brands such as Amazon, Apple, Louis Vuitton, Starbucks, so many more companies. Here with more on the work they are doing and the impact they are having is Red President and Chief Operating Officer Jennifer Lotito. She joins us via Zoom in New York City. Red, by the way, their sister organization of One, which was founded by Bono and other activists to end extreme poverty and preventable diseases. So they really are just all in on fixing what ails our world. Jennifer, good to have you here with Tim and myself. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me.
No, absolutely. Great to have you here and so relevant in terms of what the world continues to fight here. You work with a lot of brands. Tell us a little bit of how you work, how those partnerships ultimately end up in raising a ton of money for some really good causes.
Yeah, absolutely. So for 15 years, Red has been focused on fighting HIV and AIDS and working with the biggest companies in the world in order to do that. That continues to be an important priority for us. But what we've realized at this point is that you're never going to win the battle against HIV if you don't also take on the other battle that the world is facing in COVID. So we have really expanded our mission to include funding for COVID vaccines, treatment, and testing, in addition to all of the all of the funding and support that we've given for HIV. And I think from a Red perspective, what's really important is we work with those companies not only to generate the money, but to generate the heat, to get people to care, to have conversations like this.
How do you get people to care in a pandemic when they're facing it each and every day? Like the thing is it's a different challenge than having someone care about something that ails people half a world away, which is, I think, a way a lot of people thought about Red previously.
Absolutely. And it's how people had thought about HIV. And unfortunately, we're starting to make the same mistakes with COVID. I think that with HIV, a lot of people think that is a crisis that is over. It is absolutely not over. We know how to end that. We have the tools that we need to end it. And I think from a Red perspective, what's really important to understand is that we have to keep the heat on it. Because right now we're in a precarious position where we do not have equitable access to vaccines. That's what this campaign is aiming to do, is to get people to care, to get people to look at this as a global issue. Obviously right now the headlines are being dominated by another variant. That variant is because we do not have vaccines in low-income countries. So while we're doing boosters here in the States and other places, less than 10% of low-income countries have gotten their first shot. So from a Red perspective, our campaign, the Code Red campaign, is about engaging consumers, engaging customers of these brands to do, whether it is our rewards campaign, today is Giving Tuesday, we have an amazing idea, which is to allow people to use their credit card rewards points. They can be turned into cash donations, and those donations can go right to not only buying the vaccines, but very importantly, getting those vaccines distributed where they're needed most.
You know, Jennifer, when we do the numbers, and we often do it here at Bloomberg, about the number of people who've lost their lives to COVID specifically, it's just staggering in terms of where we are. I think in terms of HIV, I think we all thought it was more under control. But when you look at some of the numbers globally, I was just looking at some stats, approximately 37.6 million people across the globe with HIV in 2020. Of these, 35.9 million were adults, 1.7 million were children. It's just a reminder, we have a long way to go to really getting this out of our system, you know, out of it being a really significant problem.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, which is why it's so important when we are very focused on COVID to not overlook the impact that we've had for, you know, again, RED's been doing it 15 mm-hmm. years. The disease has been around for several decades. There has been incredible progress. We are seeing people, you know, AIDS is no longer a death sentence. If you get diagnosed with HIV, there is treatment available that will stop you from passing that on to your partner, and most importantly, passing it along to your child so that we can see an HIV-free generation in our future. We will not do that if we don't keep up the work that we're doing to fund the HIV programs, as well as now what's needed to end the COVID pandemic. And again, that's what this campaign is meant to do, engage people. You know, we have, you know, RED is known for our incredible products. So you can now shop RED. And, you know, I would encourage everybody to go to codered.org and you can find out how to use your credit card rewards points, as well as shop, as well as game. You can even play Minecraft. You know, and we're really about making sure that we are giving customers and employees of the world's biggest brands the ability to help end this pandemic.
Jennifer, how long do you think RED will have to exist?
You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, at one point we talked about, like, wouldn't it be amazing if we put ourselves out of business? You know, I think that RED is a really innovative model. And I think that right now, again, unfortunately, we're still battling the HIV pandemic. We are now battling COVID. I don't know what's going to happen, if there's going to be another one coming around the corner. But I think what's really special and unique about RED is our model. So whether our mission mm-hmm. changes, you know, I think that we will continue to find ways to innovate that model and ensure that we're engaging the world's biggest companies along with their customers.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Hey, Jennifer, good luck with the mission. And again, codered.org. You can find out more information there, and certainly shop Code Red, as she talked about. She is, of course, Jennifer Lotito. She's President and Chief Operating Officer at RED, joining us via Zoom in New York City. Great question that you asked. Right, like, the goal is to maybe put yourself out of business.
Exactly.
But it does, when I think about pandemics, right, we've been told there's going to be more.
Right, and if you're not focusing on HIV AIDS or coronavirus and COVID-19, malaria, right? Other things that have
poverty.
To be eradicated, poverty.
Like, there's just so many issues out there.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, a lot going on when it comes to COVID. The EU has recorded at least 44 confirmed cases of the Omicron variant in 11 countries. Does say that all of the people infected are asymptomatic, showing only mild symptoms. Oxford saying there's no evidence that the new variant defeats the vaccine it developed with AstraZeneca. And Moderna predicting vaccines will struggle with this variant, while the World Health Organization warned that the variant could fuel a fresh surge in infections with severe consequences.
All of this happening, Carol, while the U.S. CDC is considering tightening travel restrictions and rules, Germany taking a step closer toward making vaccines compulsory. So a slew of news happening around the world as a result of this variant.
I feel like we've been here before. All right, so let's see what John Lehrman has to say. He's our health team editor at Bloomberg News, on the phone from Boston. John, a lot going on, trying to understand. It's confusing financial markets. It's confusing we mere mortals. I don't know. What? How
yeah,
do you?
Heck of a day, isn't it?
It's only Tuesday. Yeah, it's only Tuesday.
Yeah, I keep telling myself that because it feels much later in the week. Yeah, there's a great deal of confusing news going on out here. It's difficult to make sense of, and I think a lot of it has to do with, say, governments trying to be extremely cautious, and to a degree, drug makers as well. And yet, I think that there is a certain amount of confidence about, you know, the effectiveness of vaccines, it remains to be seen, but the effectiveness of drugs as well. Hmm. So it's difficult to put this in all of it in context, because there is news coming in from so many different directions. But so far, what the drug makers are saying, at least most of them, is that they think that their vaccines will be at least somewhat effective against Omicron.
What does somewhat mean, though? And in the context of...
I don't think we really know, but yeah. The thing is, the vaccines so far have been 96% effective. So that's a really effective vaccine. You know, you think about it, that's much more effective than the flu vaccine, right? Yeah. Flu vaccines, sometimes they tend to go between 30 and 50% effective in a given year. So they seem very effective at keeping people out of the hospital. We don't know. I think the Moderna comments earlier may have thrown a bit of a scare into people, and because they said they thought it would be less effective and we would need a new vaccine. But that's not what the other drug makers are saying. And then the other thing that, you know, countervailing that is that in the places where Omicron cases have been seen, they seem to be less severe. And this is news that's come out of both the EU and South Africa, both of which have excellent surveillance and excellent healthcare systems. Now, does that mean that these are breakthrough cases in people who have already been vaccinated, and so that's why they weren't severe? Or does it actually mean that it's a less severe virus? It's very difficult to say. Or was it just the population that was seen in? Was it younger people, children, you know, people who usually don't develop severe cases? So there's a lot of data. I mean, it's not to say we'll never find the answer to these questions. I think we will at some point. But what have we known about, you know, Omicron, I think it entered the vocabulary about 5 days ago, right? There's still a lot to find out about this. And the other thing to remember is, you know, here in the U.S., we still haven't seen Omicron. We will. There's no doubt that we will. But
is that, John, because we don't do the same kind of sequencing that other countries do?
You know, we did a story yesterday in which we sort of laid out, you know, some of the issues around the surveillance system here in the U.S., and we do a lot of sequencing. There's no question we do a lot. But the intensity of it, the percentage of cases that are tested and sequenced is lower than, say, in some countries like the UK, for example, which is the star. You know, they are the world leader in this, and which we probably ought to be trying to catch up to. And actually, South Africa does a very good job with this stuff as well. South Africa, you know, huge health problems and has to keep an eye on stuff like HIV, which has huge rates of. So they're very good with sequencing there. And there's every reason that that's why they found Omicron there, is because they're actually keeping such close eye on issues like this.
John Lauerman, thank you so much. Health team editor, Bloomberg News on the phone from Boston.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So call it storage wars on steroids to some extent. supply chain carnage creating opportunities for companies that are willing to take a chance on some random goods, Tim.
What's it going to be? Is it going to be a car? Is it going to be pumpkin seeds? Maybe some rotting fruit?
A little bit of both.
It could be all of the above. It is a fantastic story. Joel Weber is editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Jeff Wise is freelance contributor for Bloomberg Businessweek. He joins us on the phone from Westchester, New York. So Joel, how is this an industry?
Oh man, this story brought me so much joy. It was like, you know, we just keep getting horror messages about the supply chain and how everything's broken. And then you get a little gem like this that reveals that there are people whose specialty is to deal with boxes that are sort of mystery boxes. You know, it's like the little mystery
bags. Not just any boxes, though, right?
Exactly, like container boxes. And it turns out this is an industry in and of itself that we probably wouldn't write about if there wasn't some supply chain carnage. So, Jeff, tell us about how you found out about this amazing story.
Well, I was doing a story about the Ever Given. And one of the aspects of the story that was kind of drew my attention was the fact that nobody really knew what was on that ship. You know, there were something like 20,000 containers, and there were various reports. Like it had been reported that there was a life-size Tyrannosaurus Rex that was heading for a mini golf course in England. But like nice little details like that. But nobody really knew what the bulk of it was. And there was this young guy in the UK who was more talkative than most of these salvage buyers, and he kind of became like sort of an instant media star over in the UK. He was on the local news and everything, talking about what he had taken about 20 containers off the ship and was trying to, you know, figure out what to do with it. He had actually 10 containers, I think like 200 tons or something, of raw cabbage that had been picked by farmers in China, put in these containers, and was destined for Europe. And then, of course, it was stuck for 4 months.
So it was kimchi.
In the heat.
Inadvertently.
And had liquefied. It had turned into goop. And so this is a guy who, you know, became the centerpiece of my article for Business Week. You know, he can both turn around stuff that has some value left in it, or he can take stuff that's absolutely toxic or dangerous or whatever. It has to be disposed of. So he whatever it is, he kind of uses his cleverness and his connections to find out the best thing to do with it.
And how is it that you know, in 2021 that, you know, these could be mystery boxes? Isn't it, don't the companies that transport these containers know exactly what's in every container?
For the most part, yes. Each container has a manifest, and it's sealed, and so there's not supposed to be any tampering, but there's shenanigans that go on, and sometimes the manifest is vague. In the case of the one that I wrote about in the story, it just said household goods, bracket, car. And they're like, what that meant is anybody's guess. Like, what value do you assign to that? It's like a complete, you know, random guess. But he was telling me sometimes, this wasn't in the article, but there's a trade where people basically, because it costs money to dispose of stuff, especially dangerous stuff. So what they'll sometimes do is they'll bundle up, you know, correctly, say plastic recycling in the front of a container, and then behind that it's like either just junk or garbage or something hazardous. And then you ship it, you know, to Asia or to Africa, and then it's you know, effectively you're disposing of it. The same day I was there, he showed me the car. He had a load of tires that had been illegally shipped off and had been sent back, and so he was going to dispose of that.
So I understand why someone might not claim 20 containers full of what was formerly known as cabbage.
Right.
But why would something like that car not get claimed? Like, how frequently does stuff just not get claimed at the port?
He is not a detective. His job is just to figure out what to do with this stuff, and he, like, the quicker he can do it, the better. So yeah, my instinct is the same as yours. I'm like, how do you? But that's not his approach. So he doesn't know. Like, he has no idea what happened. This guy could have died. He could have just, like, looked at the storage charges and been, I don't want to deal with this anymore. But this is a real problem. You know, the containers sit there, and whatever's in it is not gaining any value, and the costs are mounting. I actually wound up, I was over in the UK doing a couple of stories, and I wound up sharing a cab with a woman whose son was in the furniture importation business, and she was telling me he was looking at, he might go bankrupt because there's such a shortage of truck drivers. Because of Brexit, all their truck drivers left. And they have a real problem. They just can't move stuff. And the longer it sits, you know, the worse the problem gets.
So I just have this image of him, like, rubbing his hands together and, like, ooh, supply chain problems. All those containers, you know, sitting out there. Is he, like, is he just, you know, kind of expecting kind of a windfall?
Well, I mean, it's been good, but there's plenty for him to do anyway. I mean, okay. this is, you know, what's so interesting about this story is that, you know, containers are kind of routinized. I mean, you're basically taking what used to be every item was individually, you know, put on board a ship by stevedores, and everything has been kind of routinized into these identical boxes and moved by the tens of thousands through these ports. And we are all around the world part of the system that is brought together. And here you have these guys who are kind of breaking that mold, and they're sort of taking things back to the idiosyncrasy that's kind of inherent in all these little transactions that are packaged onto these boxes, which doesn't answer your question at all, I grant you. But,
okay, that's all right. It's still interesting.
But I guess another way of asking it is the problem getting worse?
Yeah.
Well, the problem is bad there. It's like we have a slightly different problem here. We don't have Brexit, and we weren't quite as affected by the blockage of the Suez Canal, which had these sort of ripple knock-on effects over in Europe, but not so much here. But we do have the kind of COVID backlog. You know, the president had a press conference last week where he specifically addressed this. And the people that I talk to, everyone has kind of a different sense of how long this is going to look, but it was anything from 8 months to 2 years this is going to be with us.
Yeah, I just think, like, a guy like this, it's just like, it seems like this would be, like, Christmas every month.
Unless you're getting...
And it's like, I have a six-year-old, it's like, you know, anything that's wrapped up is like a big surprise, and like, this is like Christmas every day
even
of the
rotten
year.
Cabbage.
They're very counter-cyclical, right? When things are going bad for everyone else, it's good for them, right? The more stuff... Every time things rot or go awry, these guys are here to pick up the slack. But I think there's, you know, even when things are quote-unquote normal, things always go awry.
I'll pass on the cabbage and say yes to the sedan.
Even though it's a 2014.
So what? I probably could sell it more now than I could have in 2014.
There's no title with it. Yeah. There's no title with
Who
it,
needs
Joel.
Chips?
Yeah, supply demand.
Six-year-old car.
You'll sell that car quickly. All right, Jeff Wise, this is a great read. Freelance contributor to Bloomberg Businessweek in the upcoming issue of the magazine. Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Businessweek in our interactive broker studio. Pumpkin seeds. Cabbage.
Hopefully not rotted.
No, I know. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Among our most read stories on the Bloomberg, this one is about a secretive robot that is helping one investment firm locate winners. Robots in finance, they're not new, Tim, but this is something different.
Yeah, this is not just about picking the winners, but it's about avoiding picking the losers.
Right. Right? Really? It's the same thing with investing, right? It's not only about gaining money, but it's about making sure you don't lose a lot of money.
It is, but there's also a big human element involved. Unfortunately, we have Ed Hammond at Deals Report
for
Bloomberg News. A human, not
I think
yet
last time we
by
checked.
A robot. Although, yeah, he gets scoops like like some sort of superhero. Ed Hammond, great to have you with us this afternoon. Tell us about this robot that Stripes is using and has been using.
Great to be with you guys. Look, I think the first thing to say is, yes, the robot is secretive, but only because Stripes itself is secretive. It's a very, very private equity firm. And by that, I mean they have never done a press release. They've never done an interview. They don't really go out and make any noise about what they're doing.
You know what, Ed? You know what's
I've
so
never
funny?
Heard of that.
You know what's so funny, Ed? On our call this morning, on our call when we were talking about doing this story, I said, what is Stripes? Am I? Should I have heard of this company?
Felt really stupid.
Yeah.
No, but you shouldn't, because that was where I was. I became interested in them because some of their portfolio companies were going public and were having these insane IPOs and becoming quite well-known brands. And I was like, well, who's this company that keeps showing up again and again and again on the shareholder base? And no one seems to know anything about. And then looking into them, even with the might of Bloomberg and all of our data, I was like, we don't show a huge amount about them. This has got to be an interesting story. And so I dug in and dug in and eventually started to piece together this thing that they have, which I think is fairly unique in private equity, which is that they're using, you know, what has been a long-term trend in hedge funds, sort of algorithmic trading. They're using that same kind of technology to actually source deals. And then they're using humans to go and build relationships to get into those deals and then help manage those companies through their, you know, through their growth from early stage right the way through IPOs. And it's something that has obviously worked extraordinarily well for them, at least thus far.
Well, and it sounds like the more data Sonar, right, is it's known internally. But the more data it accumulates, the smarter it seems to get. And that's helping it avoid losses, right?
Right, exactly. So, and this was a key point of the story. It was like, yes, it has these great return numbers and, you know, long-term IRR that is way above what would be considered normal in the industry. But actually, the more interesting part to me was that, like, over a period of time, its loss ratio has gone to sub 1%.
Right.
Which is almost unheard of in investment. I mean, really, what that means is that, like, if you pick 20 investments in a fund, you're losing money on almost none of them. I mean, it's just a remarkable thing to do. And obviously, the robot is a big part of that because it's able to refine the companies that it puts in front of the investment professionals at Stripes. And so you have what seems like a very, very good and consistent investment model for them. The key thing that they said to me when I was sort of digging into this, and they weren't cooperating with me on this piece, but they did say, look, the technology is only useful for our firm. It wouldn't be something that anyone else could just plug in and go. And I think what that means is that the kind of investments the robot picks are ones that actually make sense for the investors at Stripes and for their professional expertise. It wouldn't necessarily work at any investment firm.
Ed, what is the data that they're able, that Stripes is actually, and the Sonar robot is actually able to dig into? Because these are private companies. So this type of data isn't readily available. So what does it look at? What are the inputs?
Yeah, it's a great question. I obviously was not able to establish exactly what it looks at because that would be sort of giving away their secret sauce. But it takes from a very wide range of different data groups and fact sets. And some of that is, you know, news articles like we write on private companies. A lot of it is stuff like customer satisfaction surveys, credit card scans, and sort of more granular stuff. The interesting thing is how it scores. It, from what I understand, it has a scoring mechanism that sort of puts a tiny, tiny proportion of the companies it looks at in the sort of the box that says to the Stripes investors, this is a top scorer for us.
What are they invested in?
Cookies.
Cookies. That's right. They're in Levian Bakery.
Did you get to eat any of those, Ed, for your reporting?
That's something I haven't done yet.
Okay. You and me, we're
on
going.
My list. I'm up for it.
Third Avenue, Upper East Side.
I might even order some for the office.
You should.
I'm in studio. But they're in Cookies. They are in Parade, which is this like fast up and coming underwear group. They're in On Running. They're in Monday. They are in Remitly, which is a cash transfer app. They're in a lot of different companies and a lot of very successful companies, and four of which went public over the summer and have had, as I say, sort of like rapid growth, even post IPO, although that may have cooled off slightly today, but along with everything else.
But it's interesting when we know that there's a lot of money chasing, especially a lot of younger companies, it does sound like that this is giving them a big advantage, both on the upside, but in particular on the downside as well. Ed Hammond, thank you so much. Bloomberg News deals reporter Ed Hammond on the phone in New York City. I love this story.
I love Levain Cookies.
Okay.
I didn't know that they had private equity investment.
But you just think about it, right?
Yeah.
Like, and ultimately, these companies go public. If you get in early enough, you think about the potential
for
rewards. You need the robot. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
I'm driving in my car.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no. This is not a toy.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive, stay in prison.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. We are pretty much at our lows when it comes to the S&P and the Dow, a little bit off of it when it comes to the NASDAQ, but definitely it does feel like a recalibration when it comes to investors as they try to make sense of Jay Powell's testimony today, because he certainly seemed a little bit hawkish, but keep in mind, rates are still low. Let's see what Aaron Cannon has to say, co-founder and chief executive officer at Clear Harbor Asset Management, over $1 billion in assets under management. Aaron back with us on the phone from Stamford, Connecticut. Hey, Aaron, it's been interesting the last week or so. Certainly concerns about the latest COVID variant. And then we had Jay Powell today. What was the most significant thing you think we got from the Fed chief?
Well, certainly the pivot around the acceleration of the taper. We knew the taper was coming, but the notion that perhaps they would accelerate it by 2 months just sort of suggests that Powell has pivoted from a belief that inflation is transitory to now being seemingly concerned about the sort of stickiness factor of inflation. Of course, you have the other headwind of the uncertainty factor around this new variant and, you know, the question around transmissibility and lethality and whether or not the current vaccines will prove effective or not. And so sort of the perfect elixir for higher volatility, which we've really seen now over the last several days. I think we bottomed on through this year and implied volatility at about 15, and it's up over 27 today. And as you noted too, long dated treasuries are lower today, even though Powell is seemingly concerned about inflation. So I think that sort of suggests to me that the market is maybe believing Powell around taper, but not so much around the idea that he can convey a more aggressive tightening program around a higher Fed funds rate in 2022.
So, Aaron, help me reconcile these competing forces happening right now. One is Fed Chair Powell's comments about taper, and the other one is about this transmissibility or it's unknown and the new variant running rampant throughout the world right now and the concerns around that, because that could lead to shutdowns and it could lead to a decline in economic activity.
Yeah, Tim, that's a great question, because it's almost odd in my mind that Powell would decide this week to sort of pivot on the issue of inflation when there's really no new inflation data this week. And 2 weeks ago, he was a little more certainly in the transitory camp. So I'm a bit baffled by that, and I wonder if this is akin to the sort of taper tantrum of 2018 just before Christmas. With that said, the virus, at least at an anecdotal level, may be less lethal and yet is more transmissible than the Delta variant. Now, that's quite normal that this would occur as a virus is trying to sort of remain, quote-unquote, alive in a population. Transmissibility tends to spread, and lethality tends to move lower.
Aaron, it says something, though, right, for Jay Powell, to Tim's point, that he was comfortable enough in, you know, an environment where over the past 3 days we've seen volatility in a big way, and we've seen the concerns about the variant. But for him to still feel confident in his testimony and going before lawmakers to take the word transitory off the table, to say that we might speed up the pace at which we cut back on those asset purchases, does it speak to the underlying strength that he sees in the economy, even with all of that going on?
Well, I don't know is the short answer. But, you know, I must confess, I'm sort of in the camp that still believes that if it were not for COVID, we would not have an inflation problem. And that if we do have a post-COVID world, if COVID can dissipate to the point where the global economy can normalize, and is that a 2022 event or 2023 event, we do not know. But I believe it is something for the future, that there is an episodic or transitory or whatever term you want to use, nature to inflation. And bottlenecks should subside, and some of the sort of structural headwinds to inflation should also rear their head again, which is that, you know, we do have an aging worker population. We do have a declining global rate of population growth more generally. Productivity gains through technological advancements should prove disinflationary or continue to prove disinflationary over time. But, you know, there's also the other side of this that I think we need to be cognizant about, and maybe this is where Powell is right now, and that is there's a bit of a deglobalization effort underway, where I think a lot of corporations are realizing that
the notion of just in time may be less important than, you know, having, you know, as the phrase is, just in case, having, you know, production here in the United States or with our neighbors and not with a nemesis economically and militarily. And so that can be inflationary over time. And maybe that's a sticky part of this equation.
Hey, Aaron, we just have about a minute left with you. And I'm wondering if on days like today, you're getting calls from clients because they're so used to seeing the stock market, at least in 2021, go one way, higher.
Yes. I mean, to be honest with you, our phones have been quiet on that front. And I think that's because we stay in touch with our clients. We have an asset allocation and a risk management framework that's unique to each client. And so the idea that a client may need cash today or tomorrow doesn't mean we run out and have to sell equities in this market today. That would mean, I think, that we're doing something quite irresponsible in the planning process. So I think our clients are probably reasonably calm about where things are. They know that volatility is a natural function of markets. But they also know that we're, you know, looking after their asset allocation and that we're creating a risk-adjusted portfolio that's specific to them, both for the short, medium, and long term in their financial life.
Well, it's for me, it just feels like there's a recalibration of so many different things going on, whether it's in the energy markets, whether it's in demand, whether it's people leaving the workforce for good and just different things going on. But we're definitely seeing things play out in the market. Hey, Aaron, thank you so much. Co-founder, Chief Executive Officer at Clear Harbor Asset Management, roughly $1 billion in assets under management, with us on the phone once again from Stamford, Connecticut.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.